London dropped its dignity.
Yeah.
So has France and Germany.
Yeah.
All hands are dancing to a raggedy melody full of originality.
Sing it, though.
Hello and welcome to episode 25 of yesterday's Chip Paper, the fortnightly or bi-monthly podcast where we look through old newspapers and pull out things that make us smile.
That sounds like the lamest thing in the world.
Yep. My name is Jim.
That's true. I'm Violet.
Hello.
And usually we are a pair of transatlantic researchers. Jim is in New York and I am in London, but...
today... we are in the back room of a community centre.
Oh, yeah.
Where I've just seen a load of guys getting changed in a toilet.
Oh, yeah.
And there might be a squash game breakout at any second.
You know where it does are.
Yeah. This is, this is probably about the level that we deserve.
Yeah. I agree.
Every couple of weeks we get together, usually by Skype or whatever, but this time in person, sitting opposite each other. We're talking like... my microphone is tied to a mic stand using a scarf. And I'm not
ungrateful. You're talking like that.
Was it Mick Jagger who used to do that? I'm not ungrateful for the opportunity to record in a studio. This is rustic. So every couple of weeks we get together and we tell each other a story that we found in newspapers pieced together from very many articles and lots of different archives and things. And this week it is Violet's turn to tell me a story that she has found in a newspaper. So Violet, what have you found?
I have found the story of Franklin R. Voorhees, or the demise, rather, of Franklin. He was the head of a prominent brokerage firm dealing in war supplies.
Right, which war?
World War One.
Ooh,
this was
the bad one.
The 51-year-old had recently landed a huge deal supplying materials for making explosives to their allies.
Right.
He was acting as an agent for the French and British governments.
Right.
He lived with his wife, daughter, and two maids in the affluent area of Hyde Park in Chicago.
Ooh.
Which is just as nice as the Hyde Park area in London, turns out.
Is it?
Yeah, apparently. It's where... So I googled it just to see what it looked like, and it's famous now, apparently, for being where Barack Obama lived during his presidential
years. That's quite cool.
So yeah, it's a very nice area.
Wait, that's surely the White House?
His real house.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know they did that. I thought that was just the current... Yeah, never mind.
No,
okay.
I don't know. But anyway, on the 23rd of October 1915, Voorhees left his office in LaSalle Street... around 10:30 a.m., saying that he was going to the Illinois Athletic Club.
Right. To record a podcast, presumably.
Presumably. I think he had a good one on newspapers.
Yeah, yeah. Next to squash court.
Wearing a diamond-studded brooch and ring, fancy. He arrived at the club half an hour later and stayed until around 6 that evening.
How long was he there?
So he arrived at about 11, 7 hours.
This isn't an athletics club.
Yeah, see, I mean, it was an athletic
club. Yeah.
At that time, he received a phone call at the club, was heard to say, right away, and left for home. As per usual, Voorhees boarded the Indiana Avenue 47th Street car, alighted at Ellis Avenue, and walked the last 100 feet to his house at 1016 Hyde Park Boulevard. At 6:43 p.m., he unbuttoned his overcoat to retrieve his keys, but when he reached the steps of his front porch, a hand grabbed him from behind.
Mm.
The gunshot
Ooh.
Brought his family and neighbors rushing to his aid, but Voorhees died of the wound to his abdomen shortly afterwards.
The hand was redundant.
What, the hand grabbing?
Grabbing was redundant.
Well, it might be important later. Maybe. Mm. I don't know. Okay. We'll see.
I'll wait.
So that's me paraphrasing a huge report that appeared in the Chicago Tribune.
I appreciate the paraphrasing. That's great.
As I mentioned, I mean, Hyde Park, it's this very kind of upstanding area of Chicago. And the street on which the Voorhees family lived was generally very busy, especially at that time, with it's a main road that they lived on. And so everyone was taking streetcars or driving back from work.
It's weird because his descendant, Jason, spent most of his time in a summer camp. Yeah.
What? Jason Voorhees?
Jason Voorhees, yeah.
I don't know who that is. I'm sorry.
I mean, it's fine.
But it was a great joke, though. No, I could laugh for it.
It wasn't even a good joke. It was a terrible joke, badly received.
Well, good. I'm glad. But even though the police rushed to the scene and a number of witnesses had seen Voorhees walking home just moments before, his assailant had disappeared into the night, taking his eye-catching diamond brooch with them. The last thing he's reported as saying to his wife as she rushed to his aid was, "He got my pin, but he didn't get my ring."
Yeah, but he killed you.
Those were his, as reported, those were his last words. He was just like, yeah.
Yeah, small victories.
Still got it. For the next 24 hours, the authorities scoured the surrounding area for clues. They interviewed dozens of witnesses as well as Voorhees' friends and colleagues to try and figure out what had happened.
What year was this?
1915.
I don't think the Chicago police would have spent this much effort if Voorhees was like, works in the meatpacking district or something.
Oh, no. Yeah. No, it would have just been, so how long do you think it'll take to clear this stuff up?
Yeah, exactly, or, yeah. Just kick him in with the pigs.
But despite their best efforts, they didn't turn up any solid evidence of any kind, basically.
I mean, yeah, okay.
2 days after the murder, on the 25th of October 1915, the Chicago Tribune printed 4 key theories that were being investigated. The first one was the main theory that the police were looking at, that Voorhees was shot and subsequently robbed by second-story workers he caught in the act of entering house by climbing drain pipe.
Punctuation expensive in
yeah.
Chicago. Yeah. Not punctuation, grammar.
A window of Mrs. Voorhees' bedroom is, so this is quoting the Chicago Tribune, is directly above the spot where the broker encountered his assailants.
Right.
Running past one side of the window is a metal drain pipe, which extends from the roof gable to the ground, not 3 feet from where Mr. Voorhees was shot down. About 3 years ago, 2 second-story robbers climbed the drain pipe, admitted themselves through the window into Mrs. Voorhees' room, and stole $2,400 worth of jewelry and silver.
Wow, it was 1915 money as well.
Yeah, just from her room.
Wow.
Among other things, they also took a master key, which opens every other door in the house.
See that?
Stupid move.
Keep that in a safe.
The man with that master key would be a good one to locate, said Captain Levin. I agree.
Good policing, Captain.
I think, give that man a promotion, Jesus Christ.
We want a man who's recently fired a weapon.
I think when we get the murderer, we will find he is an expert jewel thief and very likely a former pickpocket. He showed himself a professional and an artist in the way he snipped the diamond off that pin. The police were never able to trace the robbers or to recover any of the jewelry from that first robbery. Voorhees took steps to avoid a repetition of the robbery, at least by means of entrance by the drainpipe route. He caused strands of barbed wire to be pinced around the drainpipe, hoping thereby to afford some protection to his wife's room. Hundreds of passers-by who looked at the house yesterday pointed out the barbed wire barrier which the broker had put up for the protection of his home. Which is ridiculous.
Is it?
That the idea of hundreds of people just being like, oh, look.
It's a wire. Is it Christmas? Are they fine?
The second theory was that Voorhees was followed by diamond spotters who attacked him in the dooryard of his home. A number of witnesses reported that a man followed Voorhees off the streetcar and that he was evil-looking.
The man was evil-looking?
Yeah, the man who followed him was evil-looking, well, not Voorhees.
He probably killed him.
While one woman also described seeing a man with pincers.
Oh.
The third theory was that Voorhees was ambushed by hold-up men who lay in wait for him in the bushes and shrubbery in front of his home.
I believe that one.
That one seems quite a good one. Mm. First Deputy Superintendent of Police Herman Schutler, whose men worked on the murder, holds the belief that Voorhees was killed by hold-up men. Human tigers was the phrase used by the veteran thief catcher.
Why has he made them sound awesome?
To describe the murderers. This is true. Now people are like, oh man.
They sound great. Cool.
Maybe I'll try that. They are not of the same type as the old money or your life robbers, he said. These human tigers killed for spoil. They do not rob by means of the cleverness of a good thief. These tigers rob by murder only.
Back in my day.
The final theory was that Voorhees was assassinated by war fanatics who later robbed to hide motive. So I mentioned earlier that Voorhees had recently signed off that deal supplying France and Britain with war munitions.
Right.
Well, allegedly, those supplies were also making their way into the hands of the Germans.
That's a flub. That's a major flub. That's exactly not what you want to happen.
Albert E. Starkey, a business associate of Voorhees, gave out a statement attributing the shooting to Voorhees' activities as a broken ammunition materials for the Allies. Since last August, it has been known generally we were doing an enormous business in supplying materials for making explosives, both to the Allies and to the Germans through an indirect route.
And this is 1915, so the Americans aren't in the war yet.
Yeah.
So they have really no skin in this game. So he can,
this is true.
He can do that. It's a free world. And also, Voorhees is a Dutch name, I think, but there's enough Germans in the US who identify as German at this point. That kind of went down after the Second World War.
Mm.
But there's a lot of Germans, plenty more Germans than are English and French in the US. So, fuck it.
This business associate went on to say, 2 weeks ago, a mysterious man of medium build with dark hair and well-dressed hung about our office and peeked in several times. Mr. Voorhees mentioned it to me at the time. We were on watch for such things, however, and paid no attention to it.
We were on watch.
Foolish.
It happened, and we ignored it.
Decided to ignore it.
Turns out, not great at watch.
So, I mean, we've got four semi-credible theories there.
And the semi-credible theories are, right now, one is, the one I like is the hold-up men, the human tigers.
Yeah, hiding in the bushes outside.
Another one is someone shitting up the drainpipe.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is war fanatics.
The master key they stole 3 years before? Maybe.
But,
you know.
And then what was the other one?
War fanatics and someone who saw him on the streetcar and followed him. Because of his illustrious diamond brooch.
War fanatic and human tiger sound like MMA fighters.
I would watch that fight.
I still think MMA was pretty boring, but
the police said that they didn't attach too much weight to the war fanatic theory, focusing instead on their original suspicions of the guy with the master key. But they just kept talking and talking and talking. There were so many articles, and they were just turning up nothing, basically.
Yeah.
And of course, this information then just started these useless debates in the papers, like whether or not he was wearing an overcoat, how much he'd been drinking that day, what the gunshot sounded like.
He had been drinking since 11.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm getting to that.
I'm not ruling it out. He shot himself by mistake.
Interesting you should say that, because I'm also getting to that.
Oh, my God. It turns out I am...
Still without spoiling anything.
I've been hiding for you all these years. I am Captain Levitt of the Chicago Police Department.
Oh, my God, I solved it.
Yeah. Took me a while.
The Chicago Tribune was, of course, the main culprit of this. And there was this one article where they sent one of their reporters to the detective's office to try on all of the clothes that they had there of Voorhees. So he was trying on, like, the overcoat and, like, the waistcoat and everything just to see, like, where the bullet holes were.
Gotta tell you guys, feeling pretty fantastic right now.
It's so stupid.
I look great.
And then there was this this character assassination of this guy who was the first guy who had gone to Voorhees' aid. Because he was originally, he was Eastern European or something. He had been in America for like 7 years, and they were like, oh, this guy, he's a bit suspicious.
I have a feeling that might mean Jew.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite possible. But
Not that I'm saying that would make him suspicious, but in the eyes of the people of Chicago of 1915, yeah, that might make him suspicious.
And then the Chicago Tribune went and did an interview with his mum. And they were like, yes, she reports that she's feeling a bit uncomfortable about all the people coming to talk to her about this. And it's like, yeah, you, because yeah, you reported that.
I would be really annoyed.
Fools.
Yeah.
So it's the 28th of October now, 5 days into investigations, and the police are following a new lead. They've taken a 36-year-old man named Leonard Buck and a 24-year-old woman into custody for questioning. And I mean, you have to listen to the reason they got arrested here, because it's pretty special. This is the first mention of the arrest that I found in an extra that was published by the Tribune. It says, the man in custody was a bookkeeper employed in Mr. Voorhees' offices, 39 South LaSalle Street. He was living with a woman, not his wife, said one detective. That's one reason they had for causing him to be taken into custody.
Yeah, yeah.
Another reason is that he had been asked to explain some checks that have been raised.
That's the reason.
Yeah.
That's the reason.
It's so stupid. But after speaking to that bookkeeper and the woman he was living with, they were both released.
Right.
And
were they allowed to live together, or was it the moral police stop it?
I don't know. I mean, they dropped that one. They literally just like picked things up and dropped them. They didn't bother following through with any of these stories.
It's amazing that like 3,000 miles away or however much in the fields of Flanders, people were being killed. That was the Battle of Loos was 1915. That was the first time we used gas. People being gassed, and he was arrested for having an extramarital affair, essentially.
Yeah. I mean,
I know those two things aren't even tangentially related.
It gets more stupid than this.
I would hope so.
But it's worth, I mean, remember the bookkeeper, because he comes back.
That is an MMA fighter I wouldn't watch.
So the papers got bored of reporting these stories on the actual murder and the suspect, because there were so many, and even they were like, okay, this is tiring now.
Right.
This is just too much information. So instead, they started reporting on the character of Voorhees himself. There was a lot of speculation around his mental state at the time and whether his business was in fact going under. And
how could it possibly be going under when there's the greatest, the greatest need of munitions in the history of the planet?
Well, this is interesting as to where that fact came from, because it's from another detective, and I don't know who this detective is, but he seems to be full of bullshit.
Right.
But I love this headline. Strange acts of Voorhees told by friend. Went into trance, failed to pay for drinks. New theory, suicide. Left only $1 in bank.
Oh.
N. Bernhardt, jeweler and friend, was the first to advance the opinion that Mr. Voorhees was a sufferer from mental aberration. On Thursday night before his death, Mr. Bernhardt said, I was with Mr. Voorhees for several hours, and he gave undoubted evidences of temporary insanity.
Ooh.
I met him by appointment, and we started to an entertainment given by the Mystic Athletic Club at the Hotel Sherman.
So a lot of athletics mm-hmm. in this.
I mean, it must be very fit. I bet he's up with all these athletics.
He was in shit. I'm amazed the bullet even went through his abs.
Just ricocheted off like Superman.
Ha-ha!
When we reached the hotel, he asked me to the bar to drink. We ordered highballs. As he sipped his drink, Mr. Voorhees appeared to pass into a trance. When he had drained his glass, he stood staring vacantly. I waited for him to pay for the drinks. He made no move, and I paid for them. And then under the subheadline, the lady in the red hat.
Wouldn't watch her fight.
He continued. Imagine if she could fight, though, and just never lose her hat. I'd watch that.
I've changed my mind. I would 1,000%
Seated at an adjoining table was a small party of women and men. One woman facing us was very pretty and wore a large red hat. She seemed to fascinate Mr. Voorhees. He stared at the woman in such a fashion that I was afraid her escort might resent it as rudeness. He began to act strangely and to speak incoherently in a loud voice. I clapped my hand over his mouth to muffle his words. I realized the man was out of his mind. He had had only one drink and was not in the least intoxicated. The persons dining near us thought my friend was drunk, and in the hum of conversation at the tables, his words were lost. Now, I have news for jeweler and friend N. Bernhardt, but he was drunk. He was almost certainly drunk.
So you think he'd turn up shit-faced?
Yes.
So he just shit out when he got there?
So admittedly, his wife had said that he had been seeing a doctor for the last 2 years, but he frequented clubs from 11 o'clock in the morning quite often, by the sounds of things. He had a liquor bottle in his coat when he was attacked. And lots of people reported, the people who had gone to help him, that he had smelt like alcohol. And there were a lot of reports from also people on the streetcar who said that he was acting a bit weird, as if he was drunk.
It doesn't need to rule out the idea that he did have mental health problems.
Like
Jane Cakebread, exacerbated greatly by a drink.
Yeah. I don't know. There was a lot of...
Also, if he died with a dollar left in the bank, I mean, in fairness, a dollar in 1915 was worth about 27,000 now. But if he died with a dollar in the bank, he might have been going through a pretty rough time anyway.
Yeah, that's true. But the night of the lady in the red hat...
Dancing with me, cheek to cheek. Do you get that one?
No.
No, God. Move on.
So, a Mr. Hillinger?
Let's go with Hillinger.
He's described as a manufacturer of silk fobs.
Described as a manufacturer of silk fobs.
By the paper.
Right. Does it say described as a manufacturer of silk Oh, did you just say
no, that? No, I said that.
Okay, sorry.
Asked if Voorhees was all right, and he'd replied, I am overworked, I am working night and day, and the strain is telling on me.
Yeah, so the guy's just burned out and getting drunk all the time. And,
yeah, exactly. That's exactly, like, I mean, he could have had mental illness, but I think it's more of a...
It's just like his situation is so stressed out. Highly strung, yeah.
But with this information about his unusual behavior, a completely different theory came up.
It was Christa Berg. He had a song called Lady in Red.
No. Oh, okay. Yeah. I get that. Yeah. I was trying to think of a song that was Lady in Red Hat. Okay.
No, that would have been, that would have been amazing.
My mum used to listen to that while vacuuming. So
good time. How loud was Christa Berg on?
What?
How loud was he on that she could hear it?
Oh, loud.
Oh, right. Christ.
So I made an exhaustive investigation of Mr. Voorhees' finances, said the detective. And I've learnt that every cent he had in the world last Saturday night was $1 in bank.
Wow. No wonder he's not paying for drinks.
So, with two life insurance policies found against his name, detectives started floating the idea that it was actually suicide.
But he just paid someone else to shoot him in the stomach.
Yeah, or maybe there wasn't anyone else at all.
They didn't the family just recovered the revolver or something. How did he shoot himself?
Yeah, see, there were some weird theories around that. They were like, oh yeah, they could have definitely hidden the revolver, and I just couldn't figure out why.
In fairness, he trains so much, he could have been so athletic, he just put an index finger through himself and it looked like a bullet hole. He's like, oh,
that's grim. But, I mean, again, those points you make are good, valid points
that
against
wasn't
this.
Just a good point. That
no,
I
not,
there,
not that,
right.
No, not okay. That immediate one.
Right.
I mean, why would they hide a gun? Like, it doesn't make any sense.
It makes total sense.
Really? To be that...
If he was like, listen, Sheila, I'm going to go out, or whatever his wife's name is, I'm going to go out... I mean, it's because I'm in a room with an Australian that I said that. I'm going to go out, I'm going to tie one on, I'm going to get wasted
maybe.
All day, I'm going to come home, I'm going to shoot myself, you're going to get the money... Just hide this gun.
I guess. Yeah.
She'd have to be quite cold-hearted in this. But I don't know. Or maybe...
That money.
Yeah. I mean, you got to keep your house on Hyde Park Boulevard.
This is true.
You couldn't possibly just sell that and move into something cheaper.
I can't imagine.
Yes, I'm telling the man to downsize 100 years after he died. I guess he did downsize fundamentally. He moved into a much smaller space.
What in heaven?
The ground. Yeah.
The ground. Oh, yeah. I was being nicer about it. But Voorhees' own son, who worked with him at the company, pointed out two major flaws in the suicide theory. A, the business wasn't failing.
Okay.
Which I guess he would say, but he was like, yeah, that detective is talking bullshit.
Right.
And B, quote, if my father had shot himself above the heart, he could not have done so without the revolvers leaving powder burns.
Yeah.
And there weren't any powder burns found on the guy who did the post-mortem said that the assailant had to be at least a few feet away from him, so it wouldn't have been...
I'm demonstrating to Violet how long my arms are, how I could definitely do it.
Maybe.
If I had a stick.
At a stretch.
I had like a selfie stick.
Don't know how tall you are. Yeah. See, there's another use for you.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So, I mean, the police are looking at a guy who'd been discharged from the British Consular Service in South America some years before, because they were like, oh, maybe the war theory kind of makes sense with him. They were looking into reports that Voorhees had like a wound on the back of his head when he'd left the streetcar, which again sounded like rubbish that someone just said.
Yeah. I mean, also, if he's wasted.
Yeah.
He could have banged it out on anything.
I guess that's true. And they're getting notifications whenever someone receiving diamonds at a jeweler's sees any new jewelry, in case it's that one, which right. is, I mean, they're jewelers, so it's quite often. So they went round in circles until two telegrams to P.D. Bryan, P.D. O'Brien, sorry, captain of detectives from police officials at Cedar Rapids.
Rapids.
Offered possibilities of a startling development in the Voorhees murder case last night.
Dun, dun, dun.
The first telegram, received early in the evening from W.H. Cleary, Assistant Chief of Police at Cedar Rapids, read as follows. John Burke gave himself up here tonight. Says he killed Broker in Chicago 3 weeks ago. Says he had three men with him. Wire instructions. 15 minutes later, a second message came, this time from S. Bergen, chief of police. It read, Burke under care of physician, suffering from delirium tremens, gives names of three men, alleged accomplices in killing of Broker. Burke says his share of the crime was $175. Remorse because papers say man and woman arrested for crime. Gives his residence, Kings Highway, New York. Says he has served 22 months in New York prison and 30 days in Chicago. So on the 10th of November, almost 3 weeks after the murder.
This is only three weeks.
3 weeks wow. later. 25-year-old John Burke handed himself in to the authorities at Cedar Rapids. It was reported that he was well-dressed and spoke clearly through his first account of the crime, explaining that he and three other men had been paid to kill Voorhees. But on further questioning, he caved into a state of hysteria. Detectives brought Burke back to Chicago, where his story was put under further scrutiny. This is quoting the Chicago Tribune. On the night of the murder, Burke said, he met three former friends, Frank McGorty, John Mayer, and William Gilbert. We hung around saloons and played pool all day, Burke said. Then McGorty said he knew a man on Lake Street who would pay us $1,000 for bumping off a man. We went out, and McGorty telephoned from a saloon on Washington and Des Plaines Street. He came out of there, and we went to another saloon and telephoned again. Then he said we must hurry and get out to the place. We went out on a State Street car to about 57th Street. We got off and walked over a way. Three of us walked on one side of the street, and McGorty walked across the street. He said he would point out the man we were going to kill. We kept walking back and forth, and finally McGorty pointed out a man that was walking along. Then McGorty came over and asked us which one had the most nerve. I told him I had plenty. He handed me a revolver, and I put it under my raincoat and walked across the street. I got to him just as he was going into his house and grabbed him by the breast of his coat. Mayer put his hand over his mouth so he could not shout, and I took a shot at the man. He crumpled up, and I put my hand in his pocket and got a wallet. Then we ran through the courtway and got to the street. I threw away the revolver. We went downtown to a saloon and I showed the wallet. McGorty grabbed it and found $175 in it. He gave me $75 and said that was my share. Then he said he would meet me at midnight with the man who would pay us the $1,000. We waited at 12th and Des Plaines Street until 3 o'clock in the morning and McGorty did not show up. I told Mayer we had been double-crossed. Mayer and I went out to the Northwestern freight yards and caught a freight. We separated in Clinton. Burke told of the movements after leaving Chicago and named several Iowa towns he visited before he went to Cedar Rapids. There he said he sold his raincoat for $1. He had $3 when he gave himself up to the police.
I think it might be Des Plaines.
Des Plaines.
It's like Des Moines. Is...
Oh, I see. Apologies to... everyone.
Yeah, every single
so,
listener.
So sorry.
For the rudimentary amount of research I've put into how to pronounce these things.
But after hours of questioning, Detective Sergeant Kane, who was leading the investigations, was still unconvinced by his story. So while Burke's statement of the actual murder seemed accurate, there were other details in his story which didn't match up to what the police had found.
Right. And also he didn't mention the diamond.
Yeah, he didn't mention that. I think he did, though, just not in that particular
instance.
Detective Kane stated that he could have just been some guy who had fallen on hard times and
then wanted to
get back to Chicago. Like he said, I think he was like, I think he just wants to go back home and so was looking for a cheap ticket.
Right.
So they were going back and forth and back and forth questioning him for 3 days until on the morning of the 13th of November, Burke and Detective Kane took a drive. Burke was taken from the city hall in charge of Detective Sergeant Kane at about 10 o'clock to go over the route taken by Burke and his companions on the night of the crime to the Voorhees residence at 1016 Hyde Park Boulevard. Here, said Burke, as the automobile containing him and the detectives reached State and Van Buren Streets, is where Frank McGorty, William Gilbert, and John Mayer took a car for 53rd and State Streets on the night I killed Voorhees. Burke spoke calmly and with a due regard for precision. We went into a saloon at 53rd Street. The party drove to the street mentioned and Burke called a halt. There's the saloon right there, he said. With a Detective Sergeant Kane, he entered the saloon of Goldstein Brothers. A man was behind the bar. That's not the man I saw when we were here. He was a taller man. It must have been my boss, said the bartender. He's taller than I am.
The bastard.
We were bad guys that night, said Burke. We had 4 or 5 shots of booze in here. McGorty went out and didn't say where he was going. Then I went out and got a package of tobacco. Come on, I'll show you where. Burke led the way to a small store owned by Mrs. N.I. Atkins. Mrs. Atkins met them as they entered, and the detective explained their visit. You remember me, don't you, lady? Said Burke. I got a package of Bull Durham about 5:15 in the evening. Oh, yes, I remember a man came in for some tobacco.
You spat at me and vomited on my floor.
But I'm not sure you're the man, though, said Mrs. Atkins.
I sell tobacco, so there were a few.
Burke pulled down his hat. Ah, you look more like the man that way, said Mrs. Atkins, but I couldn't be sure.
Hmm.
The detectives then ordered the machine.
Bear in mind, this is like 3.5 weeks later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's doing pretty well.
Yeah.
The machine. I love, they call the car the machine.
Again, an MMA fighter I would watch.
The detective then ordered the machine to 61st and State Streets. Here, Burke explained he was drunk on the night of the murder. Surprise.
Yeah.
And cannot remember just where they got off or where they went after walking 4 blocks north. Burke was turned around and his idea of directions was hazy, but the detectives caused him to walk, the machine following, until they came to Hyde Park Boulevard and Cottage Grove Avenue. Here Burke pointed to an apartment building and said, see that building there? The night I shot Voorhees, McGorty pointed it out to me and says, say, Burke, don't that look like the Astor in New York? And I said, go on, you're crazy. And we went on. And see that tennis court? He pointed to the court 1/2 block east of Cottage Grove Avenue. I remember that. When Burke reached the vacant lot west of Voorhees' home, he began to walk slowly. It certainly looks familiar around here, he said. Yes, sir, it was right here. McGorty slipped me the revolver and told me to shoot Voorhees. McGorty was following Voorhees east on the south side of Hyde Park Boulevard, and Gilbert and May and myself were also walking east on the north side of the street. When McGorty and Voorhees reached Ellis Avenue, they crossed over to the north side of the street. McGorty slowed up then and let Voorhees get ahead of us. When Voorhees was about 10 feet ahead of us, Mac slipped me the gun and told me to get him. I went after Voorhees then, and I remembered I followed him up about 3 steps onto a porch. I grabbed him and turned him towards me and shot him. I said, as I shot him, I've got you now, if I remember right. So they've been out all morning, and he's been just pointing out every single detail that he can remember from the night.
Right.
That's an edited version of the account. There was like every water trough, every road sign, every tiny thing. He literally was like, oh yeah, that was where this happened. And he had a story behind like everything
right
along the street.
Right, right, right.
But as Burke himself stated, he was drunk on the night and his memory is fuzzy.
Doesn't sound fuzzy though.
Yeah, it's weird.
It sounds like he was like, oh yeah, and then we passed this house and I caught a glimpse of myself in the window and I thought, John Burke, you're a dashing man.
I mean, it sounds like a drunk person's memory where some of it is really sharp and some of it is just like, I have no clue.
Yeah.
No idea what happened at that point.
Yeah.
But I do remember that flower on the curb and staring at it for about 5 minutes.
I think it was one of those hangovers where you forget all the good things that happen in the evening and then after about an hour of being awake, you'd be like, oh my God, I shot someone.
Yeah. Oh man, Jesus I hate Christ. It when that happens. While he's pointing out all these details, Detective Kane is finding it hard to actually pinpoint anything that he couldn't have just picked up from the papers. And like with the tennis court earlier, he's like, oh yeah, I remember that. But he doesn't, like, obviously you could point at anything and say that. So he's kind of like, I don't know. He can't prove anything.
No.
Until
dun, dun, dun.
When he was a few feet from the Voorhees home, Burke suddenly pointed to the bushes around the house and shouted, those are the bushes I told you about when I was in Cedar Rapids. And the detective asked, how did you escape? The four of us ran through that lot, pointing to a vacant lot to the east of the Voorhees home, and it was pretty dark. Did anything unusual happen in the lot that you recall? Yes. I remember that I stumbled over a plank that was down in the weeds, and I took a header. It must have been out towards the middle of the lot. Then something happened that startled the detective. A search was made in the lot, and buried under some weeds was found a real estate sign, about 6x8 in dimensions. There you are, said Burke. Do you believe my confession now? I thought it was a plank, but I knew it was there, didn't I?
I found a bit of wood in an abandoned lot.
It was that real estate sign that I fell over. I went over and gave McGorty the purse and the pin I took off Voorhees, and he gave me the $75. I don't remember which way we ran because I was stewed on booze. So they found the sign. A few eyewitnesses have said it could have been you that I saw. Right. Someone did come in at that point. Yeah. And so the detective is like, okay, but who hired you? If you're telling the truth, then who told McGorty to get you guys to kill Voorhees?
Was it the lady in the red hat?
No. Okay. But that would have been awesome. It was another thing that I told you to recall from earlier. So do you remember Buck, Voorhees' accountant, who had been arrested earlier for living with a woman who was not his wife?
Yeah, the monster.
Burke said, then McGorty began to talk about him getting $1,000 for putting Voorhees off watch. I thought he was drunk or crazy, but from the way he talked, I'm satisfied that he either had the $1,000 at the time or was sure that he would get it. About 2 months and a half before I killed Voorhees, McGorty introduced me to Leonard Burke, Voorhees' bookkeeper. That was downtown somewhere, over around Van Buren Street. McGorty said he knew Burke pretty well. That was the only time I ever met Buck. Well, Mayer and I left McGorty and Gilbert at Halstead and Madison Streets. We were kind of scared and shaky, and we went down to the Northwestern Depot and hopped a train out of town. And this is maybe the most frustrating end to a story that has ever appeared on this show.
The entire story?
Yeah.
Ah. Oh.
I thought that that was where the story was going to end. That he was, it was actually going to be this guy who had to convince detectives that he'd done this crime. Like, they got the guy who organized it all. But that isn't what happened. So they go and talk to Buck, the bookkeeper, and they're like, look, this drunk guy says that you paid him to kill Voorhees. Is that true? And Buck's like, nope.
No, because the thing is, you don't have any evidence and I don't need to own up to anything.
Yeah.
That other guy's an idiot.
So Buck says, I never met Burke in my life and I've never heard of him. I've never heard of McGorty, William Gilbert and John Maher, whom he names as his partners in the Voorhees murder. I think Burke must be crazy.
Right.
And the detectives were like, oh, okay.
Yeah, he seems it.
Sergeant Kane, who has been with this guy for like 4 days now.
Who wasn't very able.
Oh no, I get that one and it's terrible.
You get that one, you don't get Crystal back, fine.
Yeah, he was like, yeah, I believe Burke. I think that Burke paid him to do it.
You're saying Burke and Buck and you pronounce those things exactly the same.
I'm the wrong presenter of the story. But Captain P.D. O'Brien says, I am still convinced that Burke had nothing to do with the murder. However, I have ordered a dragnet for the capture of McGorty, Gilbert, and Mayer, and I expect to have Burke's sanity tested by alienists of the psychopathic hospital. And then this report came from the Pittsburgh Daily Post on the 29th of November, over a month later. Police won't jail confessed murderer. For 6 hours, John Burke, who says he lives anywhere he hangs his hat, labored mightily to convince the Chicago Detective Department that he is a murderer. Captain of Detectives O'Brien insists the man is a notoriety-seeking crank.
Right.
Detective Sergeant King has won Burke's gratitude by believing the latter's story. Burke experienced some difficulty in being arrested by Cedar Rapids detectives, to whom he told in detail how he had shot to death Frank Voorhees, war supply broker, and took $75 and a $500 diamond stud from the dying man 3 weeks ago. And that is the last report I found on the story.
You don't have... There's other things...
Except for this one last report from the Chicago Tribune, 9th of January, 1916. So between November and January, nothing.
Right.
Chronology of unsolved murders for 1915.
God damn it.
October 23rd. So there's a whole list of murders from the whole year here. October 23rd. Franklin R. Voorhees, 50 years old, killed on the steps of his home at 1016 Hyde Park Boulevard.
So it just remained unsolved?
Unsolved.
Forever?
Yeah.
I hate
you. As far as I can tell, I'm so sorry.
I came to this box in a leisure centre.
I know! Ta-da!
Jesus.
Surprise!
I don't believe Burke, to be honest.
Really?
I just don't... Yeah, I don't...
3 days. He was already in Chicago. He could have been like, oh, yeah, no, I didn't do it. They just let him go. Why would he continue convincing them for 3 days?
Exactly. Why does he want to be hanged? Because that's what's going to happen if you've killed somebody.
I guess so.
He's not.
Why would he want to be hanged though? Exactly. If he didn't do it.
Because I don't know. Maybe attention. Maybe he's genuinely.
Yeah, but he can't enjoy the attention when he's dead.
But he can enjoy the attention of the trial and everything. People don't always think logically. I mean, it's just like he's not doing it out of remorse, and the notion that he did it because someone was arrested. That person was released immediately. As innocent, like.
Yeah. See, but he might not have known that if he's only read one paper.
He could have found it out quite easily. And he could have recanted that confession and just been like, actually, I'm just a bit difficult to be around.
I guess so.
I don't know who did it. I don't think he did.
See, I thought that he did it.
Right. But they never got McGorty or Mayer or the other guy.
No. No trace of those guys at all.
Someone's making something up. Do I believe the accountant? Or do I believe the man who is wasted?
A very influential accountant on police, I would say, given their situation.
I'm this is a weird position to be in because I'm kind of on Team Burke, but also not on Team Burke because I don't think he did it. So I'm on Team Burke, but he wants me to think he did it. So I'm kind of not on Team Burke.
It's a confusing one, isn't it? Anyway, still unsolved. I guess we can't solve it. Well, I thought I'd solved it there, but now you're throwing questions at my my theory.
Well, I genuinely
makes sense though.
Incredibly frustrated. So that was hateful. I wish I hadn't come here.
Oh, I'm sorry. You can go back to the States now. That's all I needed.
I can go play some squash. So, all right. Well, a frustrating story, capably told, at least. Because this is coming out around Halloween, I think in the schedule we're going to miss Halloween with this, aren't we? It's going to be afterwards.
We might make it. Okay. I think we might make it.
So I found, if you haven't listened before, I mean, welcome. Sorry that that was your intro.
Oh, man.
Normally we have resolution.
You're in for a treat.
Yeah, normally we have resolution. Newspapers used to print letters and poems that were sent in by, they still do print letters, very rarely poems these days, but poems were all the rage. And I found some Halloween poems. And I did this a year ago for Halloween in episode 2.
Yeah, they were special.
And this is the same. This is from the Gettysburg Times in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, from the 1st of November, 1989.
What?
So I was 3.
Yeah.
You wouldn't.
I was -3.
You were a conversation between your parents saying, well, we'll buy the house first and then we'll have them.
Yeah.
So these are written by kids, sixth grade kids, and I don't want to denigrate. I don't know what sixth grade is, but
12.
There is a chance that I've been in the same room as some of these people if they moved to New York because they're like not that much older than me.
Oh my god, imagine!
And if I'm going to read your names out, so if you are listening, I'm very easy to beat up, so there's no sport in it. So there's 4 poems that I have. They're all worse than the other. I'm hoping that we can put some spooky music on this.
Oh, we can definitely do that.
Okay, so this one is by Scott Callows.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, Scott. And it goes. Witches. Terrifying sight. Black Halloween night. Brooms flying in the moonlight. Bat wings. Toadstools. Brew that is hot. Hissing black cat. Black magic. Pot.
And pot.
That pot is on a different line. So I know.
yes.
I think he means like a cold, like a black magic pot, but he's put black magic pot.
No, I think that's an integral part of Halloween.
So another integral part of Halloween, well, I guess of Thanksgiving. This is by Christine Huggins, which that's an adorable name.
And it's pretty cute.
Hey, Chrissy Huggs. Pumpkin pie. You'll taste so good. Yes, you will. Because my grandma made you out of pumpkin. And milk, and cinnamon, and ginger, and eggs. Now you're in a pan, in the oven, and we're waiting.
I absolutely adore that one.
It's just a sentence,
that one's
really.
So
isn't
cute.
It? It's
like,
this, and then there's one that is genuinely quite scary, and actually quite good by Maggie Garnett. Yeah, I've been a bit of a dick. Sorry, Maggie. Leaves falling, blowing.
Ballet dancers in the wind, leaping, twirling, whirling down to earth. Red and gold, golden red, the trees shed their costumes, floating down softly, softly comes their gold and crimson garb, whispering, whispering in the wind, murmuring secrets to those who listen.
That's actually quite a good one. I don't think I
could
write
for a kid, I'm yeah, fair enough.
For you.
No, thanks. then my last one is by Christine Volschlager.
Great name.
A lot of Christines in Gettysburg. I actually have a friend called Christina who's from down the road from there. This one is, I think, quite revealing of the life that Christine has at home. The ghost. He is as white as a sheet. His eyes are deep and black. His heart is cold and lonely. He has no love within himself. That's it.
That's the saddest poem in the world.
Yep. There's something is wrong at home.
That's really sad.
Yeah. I realize I'm talking about people that are still alive. Nothing is wrong at home, I'm sure. There's no need to be alive.
You're reading way too deep into this 12-year-old's poem.
Someone has to. Okay, and the other thing that we like to do is look at letters that people have sent into newspapers because they are the height of pettiness. And this week, I have, without question, the pettiest letter we have had in all of these 25 episodes and 2 minisodes.
I cannot wait.
It is petty, and it's short. And it's also, it's from the Hull Daily Mail on 12th of February 1930.
They're pretty petty in Hull.
Yes. I used to live in Hull.
Yeah, pretty petty in Hull.
Yep. I think the pettiness went down when I left, though. and it's the headline for this letter is No Thanks, which would be said, where they would say it, no thanks. I'm not going to do the whole thing in the accent because people in Hull are quite hard. Sir, seeing in your issue of the 7th of February about a lost left-hand kid glove, I found the glove and took it back. I just want the party to whom it belonged to know that I did not expect any reward, but I think the least he could have done was to thank me for its return. I am, sir, etc., finder. So I don't even know what the context is. It's like he's taken the glove back and the person's gone, nice one.
Where has he even taken the...
I don't know.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Did he expect him to write him a letter or
something?
No,
I think somebody posted a thing in the newspaper saying, I've lost a glove. Mm. And he found it and was like, oh, yeah. And then didn't hear
it. And they were like, okay.
Can I get out of my garden?
Yeah. I love it.
So.
Did you write it?
Yeah.
Thought so.
Yeah.
Was that my glove?
What a fucking thanks.
thanks, man.
So, yeah. So that rounds up that pettiness. This has been an episode of frustration, the mocking of children who are just trying their best, and the pettiness of an arsehole stranger.
What a fantastic episode.
Yeah. All right. So we will be back in a couple of... Oh, yes, while you're here.
Wait, don't go.
Yeah, come back. Stop. You hit that 15 seconds back button now. If you have the opportunity to rate and review us on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcast, it would really help us out. It pushes us up the rankings, gets us more listeners, and it allows us to get more feedback and make a better podcast. So we would really, really appreciate it.
We would. And also, while you're online, you can find us at Paper Podcast on Facebook and Twitter.
All of the archives that we use in the recording of this episode will be available in the episode description.
And... playing us out are Al Jolson and Sophie Taylor with the International Rag. Thanks for the
All right, we'll be back soon. Thanks, bye. The International Rag.